Well, the holiday season is over, and at least in my house. We have two married sons, and they brought their wives, and then there was Renee, who consumed my every hour with all the new toys that we had to put together and play, and invented games as we went along, and there's no real rules, but he wins every time. And for a four-year-old to have that much knowledge of how to win every time is overwhelming. We had to make a tree for him. We made a tree for us. And both those trees now are put away. The nativity scene is back in the box. And Brent Walters is here, but I did put it up, Brent, and tilt the whole time, but I put it up, and Renee loved it, and then it went back. And we also took all the decorations and put them in the garage, as most of you have done. And wow, it's over. And I was sitting in my garage early in the week, and the mail person came to Anna, and she brought the mail up, and I said, thank you very much. And one of the first letters I got is from the government reminding me immediately that I have to begin this year by getting my 1994 taxes ready for them. And I don't know about you, but that touch of reality is enough to make you want to throw up. You know what I mean? We were having such a good time. We had all these nice people. We had all these parties. We had all these presents. We had all this food we weren't supposed to eat, and we did it without guilt, you know. And we just, and then this envelope showed up, and then to mail it for us, my tax consultant put his package together, and I got it yesterday in the mail. Rather thick package, of which I'm supposed to put all these figures together, and then he just puts them in a computer and then charges me a terrible price, you know, just because he owns this program and I don't. So life can be very, very difficult. But I noticed in my week that I was struggling and being tempted to give into fear for some reason. Maybe I didn't pay enough income tax. Maybe I have to pay too much next year. Maybe I, you know what I mean? You get into this role and this fear and this worry, it just kicks in a whole bunch of other things besides income tax. And then I discovered with great relief this week that I wasn't alone, that many of my brothers and sisters are struggling also with the temptation to give in to worry, to give in to anxiety, to give in to fear. I talked to one man whose beautiful daughter is now pregnant outside of marriage. She's a lovely Christian girl that he's struggling with how to work that out. There are family relationships that are not working well. There are men who I know who don't have jobs and are asking God to give them jobs this year, and there's a temptation to give into tremendous fear about that. There are men that I know who have jobs but don't have any job security. There's no guarantee that what they have will last, and so they go to work tomorrow, and that may be the beginning of a new year or the beginning of the last day. They don't know that. There are people that I talked to this week, I'm amazed, who have already been told how much taxes they owe. And when I heard how much they just owe, it's more than I get paid in a year, and they just owe that taxes. And others who are struggling with even paying last year's taxes. So there is all this concern, all this worry, all this temptation to worry and be concerned. And as I sat there last week, I was among all the Christmas decorations, all of a sudden I realized something that was just wonderful, out of the Christmas story. And I was reminded again this week, because in our little village in Heflin Bay, we have the Catholic Church, and I noticed that during the week before Christmas, there was Mary, Joseph, and some shepherds out on the lawn, just large images. And I said to my wife, well, so where's Jesus? She said, honey, he wasn't born yet. You know, so I needed help. You know, that's why I need a wife. You know what I mean? He wasn't born yet. Yeah, well, I get that now. That's, boy, did he just get click that in? And I was so excited because on the 26th I went by and there he was. And I knew it. See, I knew he'd be there on the 26th. And, but part of that Christmas story is the foundation of which I want to build on this morning. And help all of us. I think we're all together in this. I don't think there's anyone that's not tempted to be fearful this year or worried, tempted to be worried. And I want to be among you as we work this out. But you remember the story, the angel of the Lord had come to Joseph in a dream and said that he should take Mary and his wife, and she would bear a son, which he was to be named Jesus, for it is he who would save his people from their sins. And then Matthew adds, "Now all this took place, that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled, saying, Behold, the virgin shall be with child, and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which means God is, present tense, always with us. When? In the midst of all the stuff that's coming down that makes us fearful and makes us anxious and gives us a sense of just terror sometimes. That truth translates into our very lives at this very moment, regardless of the current stressful circumstance. The truth, God is in us, will be so powerfully illustrated in the life of the patriarch Joseph as we turn to Genesis 39, please. And as we see this spiritual reality firsthand, out of this study, I hope that both you and I will take this New Testament truth, this Old Testament truth, that God is with us, and we'll take that truth into the new year and mark it as the one in which we choose, by the power of the Holy Spirit, to have the faith, to have the courage, to have the strength to live and demonstrate first to ourselves and then to all those around us the eternal reality that Emmanuel, Jesus himself, the risen Lord now, is our firm rock in the midst of the storm that will come into our lives this year and the rest of our time on this earth. Out of the life of Joseph, one of the first things we see in Genesis 39, 1-6 is that God is with us. Emmanuel is with us in the trials. 39:1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites, the traders who came out of Syria down to Egypt, and who had taken him there. Please underline verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the house of the Egyptians because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field, so that he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate. Like we all need a Joseph, don't we? Huh? In the context, which I set last week, and I don't know where most of you were, but we won't bring it up right now. At a party, you know, not thinking about your taxes, that's where you were. In the context, God had a plan, and the plan was he wanted to build a great nation so that there would be truth that comes into the world. The truth had come into the world through the prophets, through the patriarchs, and through his son Jesus Christ, and then through the church, you and I. And this particular covenant that God made with mankind, the one that we're involved in, is called the Abrahamic covenant. And the Abrahamic covenant was that God would bless all the people of the seed, the spiritual seed of Abraham. That would continue in the life of Isaac, Abraham and Sarah's son. It would continue in the life of Jacob, which was Isaac and Rebekah's son. And then it would continue in the life of Jacob and Leah, who gave birth to Judah, and then Rachel, who gave birth to Joseph. Now, all these men in time, though it took time in each one of their generations over a period of 345 years, It took time for them to grow in their relationship with God, but according to Hebrews 11, he puts them all in the hall of faith in Hebrews 11. Each one was a man who lived by faith. They grew into learning how to trust God. It took time, but they got there, and that's where you are, and that's where I am. We're learning per episode, per experience. Each time we have some trial, each time we have some circumstances out of our control, every time we have a mystery that we have to try to unravel, every time we have a conflict that we need to solve, every time we feel the pressure of stress that we get through it by depending on the Lord, that increases our faith, and he's constantly placing us in the Hebrews 11 list of those who walk by faith. Joseph will appear in the scriptures not as a perfect person, but as a man of faith, and in his life there is no mention of sin, and so you have this image of Christ constantly before us, and we'll see that just come out of the text over and over. A little more context is that in Genesis 37 you have the story of Jacob and his 12 sons and his one daughter Diana. And you have Jacob loving his son Joseph more than all the other sons because he's born later in his life. And then he gives Joseph this many-colored robe, which just irritates all the other brothers. And then a seed of hatred and jealousy starts to be watered by the way daddy is treating this little kid, this Joseph. And in time, Joseph has to give a report to father about the half-brothers and how they're treating the flock or what's going on. And apparently it's a very bad report. That doesn't help the hatred and the jealousy. And so more water is placed on that seed. And then following that, you have the incredible two dreams that Joseph has in which he calls his father and his brothers in and says, I've had these two dreams, and the dreams, I don't know what's going to happen, but the dreams say, you're all going to be around me and you're going to be bowing down to me. That didn't go over very well at all, as he told them that story with his many-colored coat on. And they knew they couldn't touch him because dad was there. And so he has these four incredible problems with his brothers. But he's kind of, in the Genesis 37, he's kind of naive. He doesn't quite get it, even though they did not say a kind word to him. But they made plans at that point to move from jealousy to hatred to murder. Now they made plans to murder him, and it wasn't an issue of whether they should murder him, but when and where. So the opportunity comes in Genesis 37 where dad sends Joseph up to check on the brothers with the flock way up in Shechem, and then they move forward up into a village called Dothan, which is the place of two wells. And he starts walking up there and sees them and expects to be greeted with a great sense of outburst. Hi, here's Joseph. How's dad? How's everything at home? How's Benjamin? And no way. They take him, rip off his coat, throw him in a dry well, argue about how to murder him. Finally, Judah says, listen, here comes some Ishmaelites. Here comes some traitors from Syria. We're on the main trail here down to Egypt. Let's sell him as a slave. And the next thing he hears is, sold for 20 shekels of silver. And is carted off to Egypt. 17 years old. They take the coat, the brothers take the coat, kill a goat, dip the coat in the blood of the goat, bring it back to the father and say, Dad, here is the coat of your son, not our brother, here's the coat of your son, and apparently he's been killed by ferocious animals with sorrows, life like that. Jacob mourns, thinks his son is dead. Joseph is in great agony as he walks towards Egypt as a slave. He who was once his favor, now is like the favor of his father. In chapter 38, you have a tremendous chapter on Judah, one of the sons, who eventually will become the great-great-grandfather of King David and then Messiah he gets involved with a temple prostitute, he thinks, which turns out to be his daughter-in-law that he broke a promise with. He has a set of twins, and it's out of twins that comes the Messiah. But behind all the hatred, the jealousy, deception, and sexual immorality is the fine hand of God, the master sculptor who has placed Joseph on his potter's wheel in order to mold him into his very own image. And after placing him in the fires, as we'll see, of trials and temptations and persecutions, he will come out as a chosen vessel through whom God would pour out his love, life, and gift of salvation for many. Now we're in Genesis 39:1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The year is 1888 B.C. We're in the 12th dynasty of the Egyptian history. We're in a season which is called the Strong Middle Kingdom. There's very few enemies that they have to worry about, and the city is prospering, especially the slave trade. So this captain of the guard, this Potiphar, goes down to the slave market and starts to buy some slaves, and among the many that he buys is this young 17-year-old boy. Now you can imagine the moment in his life, I'm sure. If you were 17 years old and you're brought, stripped probably to the waist, if not all the way stripped, standing there at 17, you who were once the favorite, you who used to wear a royal robe, you who now stand on the block naked before all this crowd, and you're listening to the bidding going on, and you're thinking through your mind, my goodness, what happened? How did this ever happen? And now I'm in Egypt, I have no family, I have no friends, I have no sense of recourse, I have no redemption, I am absolutely alone. What happened? And then to hear again the words, sold to you, Potiphar, taken into the house of the captain of the guard. It's interesting to me that when God does things in our lives, they're kind of like, as I said last week, they're kind of like isolated. You know, it's I and me and us and now and immediate. And my life has no consequences to the right or to the left, which would include you, or see any history this side or see any future on this side. And so here I stand. And yet David gives us new insight in Psalm 105. Listen to these words. This is what happened to Joseph from God's point of view. David cries out, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known among the nations what he has done. Sing to him, sing praises to him, tell of his wonderful acts. Glory in his holy name, let the hearts of those who seek the Lord rejoice. Look to the Lord and his strength, seek his face always. Then he gives this sweep of Joseph's life. Just like one stroke of a brush on a canvas. And here's what he says. Joseph, sold as a slave. This is 900 years after the event. Joseph, sold as a slave. They bruised his feet with shackles. His neck was put in irons. So what he foretold, the dreams, came to pass. Till the word of the Lord proved him true. God's at work. God is saying, I'm going to send a famine over here in Egypt. I need a man. I'm going to choose Joseph. I'm going to bring him to Egypt. I'm going to bring him to Egypt as a prisoner. I'm going to bring him to Egypt as one who's going to symbolize how my whole nation is going to be held prisoner by Egypt for 400 years. So I need a model. Get me Joseph. He doesn't call Joseph up and say, listen, we got this play and we want to know if you want to play this part. There is no conversation. Just show up. Show up above Shechem and it's all going to start up there. Joseph never had a clue, but he was part of God's wonderful plan of redemption, because later Joseph will tell his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, to the saving of many lives." We never see our life like that. And we need to. We are much bigger than the sum of the parts in the immediate present. And here is this beautiful picture then of the Lord starting to mold this young man. First he gets into the household, and he's just a slave, one more slave among many. And then as Potiphar looks at this young boy, he says, this kid's more than most of my slaves. He's got the spirit of Yahweh in him. He's told me about Yahweh, and he acts like it, and there's something different about him, and he moves him from slave to personal attendant, and then he gives him stewardship over his house and over all the fields and all the people there involved. The case of Joseph reflects the life of Jesus when the Father would send his Son into the world. And we see that as Joseph will be said by Pharaoh, "I see you, Joseph, but I see within you the Spirit of the living God." So Jesus, when he came as a servant, he came filled with the Spirit of the living God. A beautiful picture there, a beautiful image of what's going on. The story is not about the success of Joseph, but the reason behind the success: the Lord was with him. As Jesus would grow in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man, so did Joseph. But before both men would have a ministry of saving many people, each in their own time and way, they'd have to go through the fire of temptation. Doesn't matter what the subject is on temptation. The point is, temptation, though not sin, can be a very powerful influence in our lives. It can tempt us to do things that are so contrary to the character of God. And yet, every one of us have these temptations, and so how do we deal with them? So turn to Genesis 39:7-15. Now Joseph was well built and handsome, and after a while his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns he has entrusted to my care. No one's greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you." Why? "Because you are his wife. How then can I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day he went into the house to attend his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. And when she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and run out of the house, she called her household servants and said, "Look, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." Now the sexual harassment story reversed. Joseph had three strikes against him. One, he was a slave, so what was his rights? He didn't have any. The second thing was he was well built. Buff, you know, to make one of the modern calendars. And then he was handsome to boot. 17. And so as he's working around the house, here is this official's wife, has everything and is bored to death. Has no concept of anything about giving her life away, but taking from all and everything that's in her sight. And she just decides one day out of her boredom, "Hey, you, come here, go to bed with me now." It wasn't a suggestion. He's a slave. She is Potiphar's wife. The most interesting thing it says in my Bible, but he refused. He just said, "No, I can't do this." This is an amazing moment, because out of his background, he comes from living in Shechem, which is part of a Canaanite society before Israel settled the land, and it was a very perverted society. He got word about all the perversion. He knew about all the breakdown in the moral fabric of that community. And then the men of Shechem raped his daughter, I mean his sister, Diana, so he knew about all that. He knew about how easy you could use men and women, and so the moral fiber again was kind of challenged. And then he knew about his older brother, the firstborn, Reuben, who went into the wife and had sex with Jacob, his father's wife, Bilhah. He knew about morality and immorality before the law was ever written. What, 500 years before Moses ever wrote it down anywhere? He'd already had a theology in his own heart that he had developed and heard about from his father, from his grandfather, and probably some of the stories out of the life with Abraham. And so he understood that it was wrong to commit adultery, and he understood that he was not to covet his neighbor's wife, and he was to understand and would understand an eternal principle that Paul writes about to the Thessalonians when he says to them, when they're struggling with their moral fiber and the issue of sexual immorality, the issue of prostitutes and shrine prostitutes, Paul says, this is present tense. This is always present tense. This will always be present tense. This is the will of God, your sanctification. That is, set your heart, set your life aside unto God so he can express himself through you. This is always the will of God, your sanctification. That is, avoid sexual immorality. Avoid any sexual activity outside of a marriage relationship. And may it all be pure from heart and then body within the marriage. So he understood that principle. But how did he understand that principle? Where did he get that deep theology? Where did he get the courage? Where did he get the moral fortitude to say, no, I refuse to get involved? Well, we have this incredible God, Emmanuel, the one who is always with us. The God who spoke to Adam and Eve and described sin to them in the garden. This is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Don't touch it. There is good, there is evil. Don't touch the evil, just touch the good. What is evil? Evil is anything that's contrary to my will. My will is don't touch the tree. If you touch the tree, that's sin. You missed the mark. That's it. Stay away from it. I got it. Nobody did anything about it. I mean, whether he, as we know now, he didn't. He didn't go beyond that. I got it, but I'm still going to play with it. He gave into the temptation of the great tempter. Cain knew about sin when he brought a sacrifice not in faith, got another chance from God, and God said to him, I want you to know that there's a way to overcome this. If you will not, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up in Genesis 4? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door and its desire for is for you, but you must master it. He knew about sin. Cain and Abel knew about sin. Adam and Eve knew about sin. Noah knew about sin. They all knew who God was and how he revealed himself and what his character was all about, how he was holy and pure. They knew about that. Noah was told by God to build an ark because the intent of everyone who lived on the earth at that time was bent towards evil. And so he's going to destroy the earth. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Joseph were all confronted by God himself, personally, by angels. Abraham was approached by Melchizedek. So truth was continually in the community of those who walked by faith. And that's called direct revelation. Then there is this indirect revelation, which Paul writes about in Romans 1. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them by their spirit, by his spirit, For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, which is that of holiness, has been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And so, Joseph looks at the situation. He looks at the temptation. He looks at the woman. He thinks of his master. He thinks of his master. And he says, no. This proposition is a wicked thing. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? He's more concerned with his relationship with Emmanuel than he is with his relationship with a woman or his relationship with himself. He doesn't care about his wife at this moment. He says, no, this is wicked and it's a sin in the sight of God. I'm not going to, in spite of my relationship with this Egyptian deal, in spite of the fact that I come out of this kind of situation which is all unjust and unfair, in spite of the fact that my brothers hate me, and the fact that my father doesn't know where I am, the fact that I'm a candidate for a recovery program has nothing to do with my relationship. No, I'm not going to give in to this sin. And so he doesn't. Would that King David would have the same moral fiber when he saw Bathsheba. And yet in that case, we also find that God was willing to extend mercy and forgiveness to David. And all of us who sin against him when we're willing to confess that sin, but not without personal consequences. So now he's falsely accused. Now it's no longer sex. It's an issue of power. It's an issue of position. So she grabs his coat and says, now you come to bed with me. And he flees. I tell you, there's a time when you're in the midst of temptation that you have a lot of time to think through some theological discourse that you can have with those who are tempting you in a sense. But I tell you, this is one of those temptations where you have no theology except within your heart, and you move out of there quickly. You don't walk away, you run away. Because it'll destroy you forever. And so, according to Proverbs, there's just so much written in Proverbs 6 about that. The adulterous woman who will lead you to the total destruction. And so, Peter would write later, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Would to God that every time we were in some temptation, that you could hear the roar of the lion. It would just be a nice little encouragement. Get out of here, or you're dinner. You know, that simple. You're just dinner tonight. Someone's about to eat you up, and you're dinner. The image of Christ here, the life of Joseph. Before Jesus began his public ministry, he was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. Later, the writer to the Hebrews would remind us, for since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. And so we have Joseph standing there in a position where now he refuses to give in to the temptation. But there are, if you make that choice, certain consequences. You don't get away scot-free. And so God is not only with us in our trials and our temptations, but he's also with us in our unjust persecution. Look at this in verse 16. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave, it's all your fault, husband. That Hebrew slave you bought us came to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me. He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in prison, underline it, please, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in his sight. in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. And then the warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. He moves from this incredible position of authority to now he's a prisoner again. Sold as a slave, bought as a slave, moved to be a steward. Now he's a prisoner. And he hasn't done one thing wrong. Not one thing. He's a victim of everything that's coming down. But you got to see it. But you just got to see it from God's point of view. He's in prison. He's in prison. He's confined. He can't get out. He's locked up. He's with all these other prisoners. He don't have a lawyer. There's nothing going on for him. And then it's a little verse, but the Lord is with him. About what? So what? I got a bunch of prisoners, they're with me. I'm the warden here, he's with me. We got the baker and the butcher, he's with me. So what? We're not out of prison. Hold on, Joseph. I got this stuff I'm doing. See, I'm bringing a famine, and then I'm bringing you out of here, and then I'm going to put you as the vice president of Egypt, and then you're going to start gathering wheat before the real famine hits. So I'm going to give you 7 years to gather the wheat. And then, see, then we're going to have the famine. And then, see, all the nations are going to come to you and to Egypt, and you're going to save many lives. And then, see, then I'm going to bring your father down. And then, see, then I'm going to bring your brothers down. And then, see, I'm going to put you in Egypt for another 400 years, you see. And then we're going to bring Moses in, and we're going to set you free. Then you're going to enter the land of Canaan. And then I'm going to keep the promise I made to Abraham all the way over there by the fireplace. So Joseph, not knowing all of this, not having a clue of this incredible history that's going on from God's point of view, simply stands there in his prison and says, "Thank you, Lord, for being with me, but I don't get it." God says, I know you don't get it. If I gave you everything at once, then you'd be God. See? You see where most of us are? We're in these kind of situations, and we want God to give us all the answers all at once, right away, and we really want to end up being God. You see it? There's no faith when you're God. Now, if you notice when I did this to you, there were four fingers pointing back at me, so don't get like I'm intimidating. I just feel like I'm with family. We understand. The Lord was with him. The Lord was with him in the same way that Jesus is with us. When he said to his disciples after his resurrection, he said, "Go and make disciples, and surely I am with you to the end of the age." And we say to him, "Well, I mean, could you be with me till Monday? Or maybe Tuesday? Can you get me through Tuesday?" Lord says, "You don't understand. My name is Emmanuel. I will be with you and 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 with you to the end of the age." Well, what happens next? Well, you cut that out. "I'll be with you." We just don't believe them. We don't act like that's true. We think there's him and us that we never quite meet. That's why we spend so much time worried. Why does God have to say the answer for nothing? But in everything, with prayer and supplication, let all of your requests be made known to God. And the God of peace will fill your heart with his peace, with his security, with his strength. Why do we do that? Well, because we're in the process of growing in our faith. That's why. And he loves it. If you just grow in your faith. So rather than do the whole sweep of history, though you ought to have a sweep of history, what you want to do is, just today, how are we doing? Remember I told you last Monday, at my mailbox, in my garage, with my letter from the government, started to get real rattled. Until I remembered the nativity scene right over here with a little Jesus and a little manger. His name was Emmanuel. And then I went, oh yeah, that's right, God is with us in my garage. Next to the stall. And he's in me. And around me. And over me. And under me. As Joseph was to suffer unjustly, so Jesus, says Peter, would suffer. For you've been called for this very purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threat, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. As Joseph was placed in the dark days of the prison in preparation to bring blessing to the nations, so was Israel to be placed for 400 years in the darkness of Egypt before bringing blessing to the nations. So Jesus was placed on the cross, buried in darkness for 3 days, but raised from the dead by his Father and from his heavenly throne, can now bring spiritual blessings to all of us who love him. And one day he will bring spiritual blessings to all the nations. We must get a grasp of God in history. It is his story. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And he never forsakes any of us in the beginning, the middle, or the end. There's going to be days when our hearts can be tempted to become fearful and worried about so many different unknown situations. But as we look at this wonderful story of Joseph, there are five phrases that you want to catch that are so important to remember in the midst of your trials, your temptations, and your unjust persecution. In verse 2 it says, the Lord is with Joseph. In verse 3 it says, his master saw that the Lord was with him and the Lord gave him success in everything he did. In verse 5, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. In verse 21, in prison the Lord was with him. In verse 23, in prison the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son. They shall call his name Emmanuel, which translates, what does it translate to? Excuse me, that's a little weak. That translates to what? You believe that, right? Huh? His name is Emmanuel, and it's translated to, please, hold on to that. That will never change. You may change, but that won't change. That's contrary to his nature to change that name and to change that position and to change that place. Out of this study, I hope that both you and I will take this new year and mark it as the one in which we choose by the power of the Holy Spirit to have the faith, to have the courage, to have the strength to live and demonstrate first to ourselves and all those around us the eternal reality that Emmanuel, Jesus, risen, empowered, is our firm rock, regardless of the storms that come to us in our lives this day. Emmanuel, God is with us. Let's stand.